This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 29th of April, 2011, and even as the UK is still basking in the ritual of the royal nuptials between Prince William and Kate Middleton, we are joined on the line from the United Kingdom by someone who would probably rather not be there. I'm referring to John Anthony Hill, the creator of the highly influential documentary 7-7 Ripple Effect, and someone who's been extradited from Ireland to the UK to face charges of attempting to pervert the course of justice contrary to common law for the vile deed of sending a DVD copy of 7-7 Ripple Effect to the UK courthouse where a trial was being held of three men connected to the four alleged 7-7 bombers. John Anthony Hill, it is a pleasure to have you on the line today. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Well, I'm sure
good to be able to get a bit of airtime.
Oh, good. Well, it's good to have you here. And I'm sure some of the listeners out there are already familiar with your remarkable tale and the extradition and court date that you will have next month to answer to these ridiculous charges. But perhaps you can tell us in your own words exactly what transpired to bring you to this point.
July, on the 7th of July of 2005, I got a phone call from a friend in London. I was in Ireland at the time, which is where I've been living for the previous 12 years. And he asked me if I knew what was happening in London. And I said, no. So he said, well, there had been some explosions in London and that it was all over the news and on the television, and said that I should turn the television on and have a look at what was happening. And so I did do that, and spent that morning flipping channels between the different news stations, seeking to find all the little bits of information that were available, because each independent reporter has a different take on what's happening, is usually in a different location, so sees different events from the other reporters. So I was flipping the channels to get the maximum amount of information that I could before the government, as they always do, before the government censors jump in and things start disappearing from the news. And I'd already been studying 9/11 since 9/11, really, since the day, because on the day when I saw the two towers come down, it was obvious that the planes didn't bring down the towers, that they were brought down by controlled demolition, which was confirmed later that day when Building 7, World Trade Center, Building Number 7, the Salomon Brothers building, came down when absolutely nothing hit it. And so when 7-7 happened, the first suspicion was that this was going to be a similar event. And so I spent the next 2 years investigating 7-7. And all the information that we got proved that the government conspiracy theory, which is all the government story, official story is, it's a conspiracy theory, and proved that it didn't hold water, it didn't stack up. It was full of contradictions and anomalies and impossibilities. And so I think it was around about the middle of October or beginning of October of 2007, somebody sent me a link to a film called 9/11 Ripple Effect. And I'd seen other films that people had made about it. But this 9/11 was made by Dave von Kleist of the Power Hour. And there was no hype in it. There was no exaggeration. It was very calmly made and just had experts on giving the facts and their opinions on the facts and proving that 9/11 was an inside job, which I'd already known since the date of 9/11. And I was so impressed with the film because it was so easy for people to follow that I asked my friends, I said, has anybody made a film about 7-7? And they said, well, there was a couple of films at that time out on the internet. One was called 7-7 Mind the Gap, and the other was called Ludicrous Diversion. And they gave me the links to watch them online, which I did. And they were both pretty good films, and they pointed out quite a few of the anomalies, some of which we'd spotted as well, but we'd spotted other ones that weren't in those films. And but neither of the films really put it together in a way that the average person could follow. And so I decided that we would make the film 77 Ripple Effect. And so that's what we set about doing. And I called it 77 Ripple Effect really because of watching 9/11 Ripple Effect. And I was, because of the fact that I was impressed with the 9/11 Ripple Effect and how it was done. So kind of as a thank you and a tribute to the makers of 9/11 Ripple Effect.
So you say you saw 9/11 Ripple Effect in October of 2007, and you came out with 77 Ripple Effect in November of 2007.
Yeah, well, we'd already got pretty much all of the information, and what I wanted to do was, in fact, it was quite a rush to get it done in time, but I wanted to get it out on the day of the 5th of November of that year. For anybody in the Commonwealth or British people listening to this, in fact, people in America, probably people all over the world, may know that the 5th of November was Guy Fawkes Day, when Guy Fawkes tried to blow up the Houses of Parliament a few hundred years ago. And so because my film shows that the government, or at least people in the, you know, working for the government, perpetrated this horrendous crime. I wanted it out on the 5th of November because my film really was there to expose the government. If you like, the film itself is quite explosive in its effect. And so I wanted to get it out on the 5th of November, and we managed it. We managed to get it done and uploaded onto the internet. To Google Video, and then subsequently it's been put on YouTube and various other places, exposing the truth about what really happened on the 7th of July, and that the four young men who have been accused and blamed and been tried and found guilty by the media, which is a propaganda machine for the government, of course, that they were innocent, that they were patsies who were set up. And they thought they were taking part in a training exercise that was being run that day by a company called Visor Consultants and possibly others. And they were shot dead later that morning after the tubes had blown up. They were shot dead in Canary Wharf. And it was reported that morning, I heard it on the news, it was reported that the actual report said that the police had neutralized, shot and killed three suicide bombers in Canary Wharf. Well, how could suicide bombers who were supposed to have blown themselves up along with other people on three tube trains, how could they possibly be still alive later that morning to be shot and killed in Canary Wharf? So that was even more evidence. And so we put the film together, just documenting all of the evidence that we found. And I put it together as a story, just telling what seemed to be the most logical story to come out of all the facts that we'd gathered together, and put it together in a way that the average person would be able to follow and understand. And the film became a big hit all over the world. It was very popular with everybody except the British government, of course. And I had emails from all over the world, people thanking me for making it, including from the UK, where I had emails saying, you know, thank you for opening our eyes. We really didn't realize, you know, how evil the government is. And we want to thank you for showing it to us so that, you know, we can hopefully collectively do something about it. And I had people from Spain, Italy and Germany contact me and ask me if I would give them permission to translate it into their languages, which I did. So there are editions now also in Spanish, Italian and German. And it was so popular that the government became panicked, I think, and afraid of the film, because it is so powerfully made that anybody with an open mind watching the film will see that that's exactly what did happen that day. And the government knows that.
Well, it certainly did have a very large effect, a large ripple effect, you might say, and continues to have so. And it was quite well received by a lot of people. But of course, as you say, there was some government interest in this project. So tell us a little bit about how this came to the attention of the UK government and your involvement in this court proceeding.
Right, okay. What happened was that the government had to try to disprove my film and discredit it. So at least that's my opinion of it. And so they arrested three friends of the original four alleged bombers and put them on trial for, I think the phrase was hostile reconnaissance for the alleged four original bombers. And they put them on trial, and they were desperate to convict these three young men so that then they could turn to the public and say, look, these three were guilty of helping the other four, so by extension, the other four must also have been guilty. And my film would, you know, was wrong. And so anyway, they put these three young men on trial, and on the first day of their trial, the prosecutor lied to the jury, committed perjury. He said that there was absolutely no doubt that the four original young men, I'll name them, it was Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, Shehzad Tanweer, Jermaine Lindsay, and Hasib Hussain. And he said that there was absolutely no doubt that those four were guilty of carrying out these attacks, these atrocious attacks. And that's outrageous for him to say that. He's lying to the jury. My film proves that the four young men I've just mentioned couldn't possibly have carried out these bombings. And millions of people doubt that they did it. So for him to say there is no doubt that they carried out these attacks, he's lying to the jury, misleading the jury, and trying to pervert the course of justice. And then later I found out that the judge in the trial, Mr. Justice Gross, when he was doing jury selection, he misled the potential members of the jury, because he said to the prospective jurors, of course you know that Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, Shehzad Tanweer, Jermaine Lindsay and Hasib Hussain carried out these atrocious attacks. And they've never been found guilty in a court of law. There's been no proper inquiry into who actually did do it. They've been tried and found guilty purely by the media. And the facts prove that they couldn't possibly have done it. So we've got the judge misdirecting the jury. We've got the prosecutor on the first day lying to the jury and saying there's no doubt that these people carried out this attack. And so they were perverting the course of justice, and there was the very great danger that there would be a miscarriage of justice and that these three innocent young men would get 20 or 30 years in prison for something they couldn't possibly have done, because three people can't possibly be guilty of helping four other people to do something that those four other people didn't do in the first place. So I sent copies of my film with the evidence that the four original ones didn't carry out these attacks to the court, to the judge, and to the foreman of the jury in the trial, because the jury were being lied to. And the judge had misdirected the jury from day one. And I thought, well, if he sees the film and the evidence, he will correct himself, and he will redirect the jury and say, I'm sorry that I misdirected you, telling you that these four young men carried out this attack, because it, you know, they haven't been found guilty in a court of law, and it appears that they, you know, that they didn't do it. And I thought they possibly might call me as a witness, perhaps naively of me. And so what happened was that instead of showing the film to the judge and to the foreman of the jury and the rest of the jury, they charged me with doing what they were doing. They were perverting the course of justice, and I was striving to prevent them from perverting the course of justice. And so they charged me with attempting to pervert the course of justice in the trial of these three young men. And incidentally, these three young men are mentioned nowhere in my film, as you probably know if you've seen it.
Yes, actually, that's right. And it's, to me, the most baffling thing about this is how a UK court could possibly try to hold jurisdiction over someone living in Ireland and extradite them for this supposed crime of perverting the course of justice. That, to me, is just unthinkable.
Yes, well, what they did was they got a arrest warrant from Westminster Magistrates Court in London. And then they applied to the European Court for a European arrest warrant and got one. And then it was ratified by the High Court in Dublin. And then the Garda, which is the Irish police, came early one morning. It was on February the 10th of 2009. And they arrested me, took me into custody, and on the strength of this European arrest warrant. And so I was let out on bail after a few days in prison, and then I was awaiting the High Court hearing. At the High Court hearing, my barrister refused to follow the written instructions that I'd given him, and so I lost the case. And then I appealed to this, and then I was taken back into custody, and then applied for bail again, and eventually got bail after a longer period of time in prison. And then went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, I was handling my case by that time because I couldn't trust the barrister that had represented me at the High Court because he hadn't followed my instructions. And I made submissions to the Supreme Court to put in all the points of law that I'd asked the barrister to use in the High Court. And the Supreme Court refused to accept that and said that I could only appeal on what was actually brought up in the High Court. So I was really stitched up. And so anyway, I lost. The Supreme Court hearing was at 11 a.m. on the 11th day of the 11th month of 2010. So it was Armistice Day and Armistice time. The First World War ended at 11 a.m. on the 11th of the 11th of 1918. So it was, I don't know why they picked that time, unless they were trying to send me some kind of a message, but it was a very strange thing to happen that it was Armistice Day when my hearing was heard, and my appeal failed. I was immediately taken into custody again, and a few days later, on the 19th of November of 2010, I was awakened at about 6 o'clock in the morning and told to get ready, and I was taken to Dublin docks and driven onto a ferry. And there were three plainclothes SO-15 anti-terrorist police on the boat with a vehicle. And I was handed over to them. I was locked in a holding cell on the ferry while we got across to Holyhead, which is just off the coast of Wales. And then when we got into Holyhead dock, I was driven from there to London to Belgravia police station, and I was fingerprinted and all of that rigmarole. And then I spent the night in a holding cell there, and then the next morning I was taken to Westminster Magistrates Court, who had issued the original arrest warrant, and remanded in custody to Wandsworth Prison in London. And I was in there for quite some time. I think I've spent a total of something like 151 days now in custody before I managed to get bail in the UK. The authorities didn't take me to the court for four hearings that I was supposed to go to apply for bail. The first one that I was supposed to go to, then they didn't take me. The judge wanted to know where I was, and the prosecution said that I was out on bail and they didn't know where I was, which was a lie, and my legal representatives said, "That's not true, Your Honour. Mr Hill is in Wandsworth Prison, and he should have been brought here today, and he hasn't been." So the judge wanted to know why I wasn't brought to court, and they contacted the prison, and the prison said they couldn't find me in their prison. Yeah, exactly. But the very next morning, at 8 o'clock, my prison cell door opened, and they took me for what they said was a random drugs test. So the day previously that they were supposed to take me to court, they couldn't find me. But the very next morning, first thing in the morning, they could find me to take me for what they said was a random drugs test. So that smelled a bit fishy to start with. And this sort of thing happened another three times until the judge got annoyed. And he said, "I want Mr. Hill here tomorrow morning without fail." And so consequently, I was taken. He'd asked for me to be brought on the other occasions, but they hadn't brought me. So he finally got annoyed with them and said, "I want Mr. Hill here in the morning without fail." And that morning, he, which was the 8th of May, of sorry, 8th of March, he granted me bail. And then it took my friends till the next day to be able to sort out paying the bond and do all the paperwork. And I got out on the 9th of March. And what I did during the court proceedings is that I've challenged Elizabeth Battenberg, because that's a real name, a married name. I've challenged Elizabeth Battenberg's jurisdiction and sovereignty of the United Kingdom. And this has never been done before, and it caused quite a bit of a stir. And what's happened is that I've filed a document, which I sent you the link to. I don't know if you want to read it out, or me to read it out, or...
I can include the link actually in the documentation for this interview, so when people click on the link from my homepage, they can find that link.
Oh, lovely. Oh, that saves a lot of messing about me. So anyway, in my filing with the court, I have challenged her jurisdiction and her sovereignty because she is fraudulently pretending to be the monarch, the sovereign of Britain, because in 1953, on the 2nd of June, she was crowned knowingly and willingly with malice aforethought. She was crowned on a fake coronation stone. And so she was never lawfully crowned on that day, and she's been masquerading as the rightful sovereign ever since, for the last 58 years.
So why did that happen? Why was she crowned on a fake Stone of Destiny?
Well, the genuine coronation stone is actually Jacob's pillar stone that you read about in the Bible. It's the stone that he used for a pillow at Bethel in Israel when he had the vision, which is known as Jacob's ladder, where he saw angels ascending and descending from heaven. And he anointed that stone, and eventually, after a long period of time, it went with his children, the 12 tribes of Israel, the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel and their children. It went with them into Egypt, and then 400 years later, with Moses, it was brought out again, and it was carried on a pole, a single pole. A ring was put into each end of the stone so that a pole could be passed through the two rings across the top of the stone, and it could be carried on a pole. And eventually it became the throne of David, and then of Solomon, and then of Rehoboam, and so on and so forth, all of their descendants, right down to King Zedekiah. And Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon in 588 BC came to Jerusalem, overthrew Zedekiah, and Jeremiah the Bible prophet took the stone and the Ark of the Covenant and the king's daughters and went to Tanis in Egypt. And that's why the Raiders of the Lost Ark film begins at Tanis in Egypt, because that's where Jeremiah went with the king's daughters, the Ark of the Covenant, and the coronation stone, Jacob's pillar, the throne of David. And the Pharaoh Hopra, gave a palace to the king's daughters, and it was called, it's there still today, well, the ruins of it are there. It's called Khazir bint El Yehudi, which means the palace of the daughter of Judah. And anyway, if you continue reading the book of Jeremiah in the Bible, in the Old Testament, he tells you that God warned Jeremiah that Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, now that he'd defeated King Zedekiah and he'd pacified Judea, that he was going to come against the Pharaoh, because the Pharaoh had been an ally of King Zedekiah against Nebuchadnezzar. So he, first of all, he sorted out Zedekiah, and then he was coming for the Pharaoh. So God warned Jeremiah that he couldn't stay there, that he had to leave Egypt, which he did, and he took the king's daughter and the Ark of the Covenant and the coronation stone, Jacob's pillar, and by ship, and over. They changed ships in Gibraltar and what. It's a very long story. So, but it, just to cut it short, they ended up in Ireland, and the eldest daughter of King Zedekiah, Tiatefi, was married to the High King of Ireland at Tara, the Hill of Tara, in County Meath, in Ireland, in 583 BC, on the 21st of June, over the stone. They gave their pledges, their marriage vows, over the stone. And then their descendants, for 1,000 years, were crowned on that stone at Tara, until around about 500 AD, when the brother of the High King of Tara went over to Scotland. A lot of the Irish had migrated from Ireland and gone across to Scotland, to Argyllshire. And Fergus, who was the younger brother of the High King of Tara, wanted to go over to Argyllshire, where the Irish Scots were, and be their king. And he knew that they wouldn't accept him unless he was crowned on the stone. So he borrowed the stone from Tara, from his brother at Tara, and took it to Dunad in Argyllshire. And there he was crowned Fergus More, which is Fergus the Great, as the first king of the Irish Scots. And then from there, the stone was taken to the Isle of Iona, and St. Columba from Kells in Ireland went there when he was censured by the Irish Catholic clergy. He left Ireland and he went to Iona, and he became custodian of the stone on the Isle of Iona. And then later on it was moved to the mainland, to Dunstaffnage, which is near Oban. And then later on still, it was moved to Scone Palace in Perthshire under Kenneth MacAlpine, who was the first king of the United Irish Scots and the Picts when they became the Scottish nation. And so he moved the stone to Scone Palace, and there it was kept, and all of their Scottish kings were crowned on it until 1296 AD, when Edward I, Edward Longshanks, from, if your listeners have seen the film Braveheart, they'll know who I'm referring to. He defeated the Scots in 1296, and he took the stone to England and took it to Westminster Abbey, had a chair built to house the stone, and the stone was placed inside the chair. And all the English kings were then crowned on it, from 1306 down to King George VI in 1937. They were all crowned sitting on that stone. But on Christmas Day, 4 o'clock in the morning, on the 25th of December of 1950, four Scottish nationalists removed the stone from the chair in Westminster Abbey, and they took it back to Scotland. They'd used a fake stone made of Scottish sandstone to practice on, and they thought that it would be the same weight, because they cut it to the same dimensions. They thought it would be the same weight as the genuine coronation stone, because they didn't realize that, it wasn't Scottish sandstone. It had actually come from Bethel in Israel. And it was a completely different type of stone and a different weight, different color, different texture. But anyway, in getting it out of the chair, they dropped it and it broke, which enabled them. They couldn't hold it because it was a lot heavier than the one they'd been practicing with. And the breaking of it facilitated them being able to more easily remove it and get it into two cars and take it, excuse me, and take it back to Scotland. And what they did was on the midday, on the 11th of April of 1951, they placed this fake stone copy that they'd made to practice with, wrapped in a saltire, which is the Scottish flag. It's the blue flag, the dark blue with the white diagonal cross. It's the St. Andrew's cross, but the Scots call it the saltire. And they wrapped the stone in that, and it was on a wooden barrow, and they left it on the high altar stone at Arbroath Abbey, which is where in 1320 Robert the Bruce and the Scottish nobles had signed the Scottish Declaration of Independence. And so they were sending a message to the UK, to the British English authorities, that this was about Scottish independence and that they'd taken the stone back. But they put this fake stone wrapped in the flag on the high altar stone there, and then the authorities found it the next day, and it was taken to England. And that's the stone that Elizabeth was crowned upon, knowingly, because the stones are 122 pounds difference in weight. The fake stone, which was made of Perthshire sandstone from quarry near Scone, weighs 336 pounds in weight. And the genuine coronation stone weighs 458 pounds. So there's 122 pounds difference in weight, which is why the Scottish nationalists, when they got it out of the chair, they got a big shock, because they suddenly found it was a lot heavier than the one they'd been practicing with, and they were unable to hold it, and that's why they dropped it. And so the authorities know, and she knew, that she was being crowned on a fake stone, and so they were committing fraud against the British people.
So have you talked to the people who were actually involved in that raid?
I've tried to, but they don't want to talk to anybody about it. They say that they put the real stone at Arbroath Abbey, and that's the end of it, you know, even though I can prove without any doubt that that's not true. It may be that they didn't know, because the stone was wrapped in the Scottish flag. So they may have left it there not knowing that it was a fake. But the person that got them up to it did know. And he's the one that will have switched the stones and foisted it upon them. But I've tried to contact... Well, Ian Hamilton is the chap who was in charge of it. He was the leader of the ringleader, as we would say, of the four Scottish nationalists. There were three boys and a girl, young men and a young woman at that time in there. I think they were about 20, 21 years old. And I've contacted him on numerous occasions, and he gets upset. And one time he sent the police to tell me to stop contacting him and stuff like that. But since then he hasn't done that, because I sent him a copy of a film that I made proving all of this. And since then he just doesn't want to talk to me.
What was that film, and where can people watch it?
It's at http://jahtrutH.net/stone.htm. There's the full story of the stone there, and there will be a link there to this movie. It's called The Truth About the Coronation Stone. And the link for that is stonemov.htm.
Excellent. Well, I will, again, include those links in the documentation for this conversation so people can go and check that out for themselves. And I have to applaud you for going to this length and taking this unorthodox defense, but I have to wonder if the court is even going to listen to this, let alone take it into account.
Yeah, well, that's the important factor, really. You see, I haven't just attacked on that one avenue about the stone. Also, at her coronation, her fraudulent coronation, she took an oath, a solemn oath, that she would uphold, well, the actual words are that she would maintain the laws of God to the utmost of her power. And she swore that oath in Westminster Abbey in front of the Archbishop of Canterbury, who is the head of the Church of England, well, the head under her. He's the head of the clergy. And then she signed the coronation oath, swearing that she would uphold God's law. And of course, she has broken it thousands and thousands and thousands of times over the last 58 years. And so if people read the document that I filed with the court, they will see where I've proved all of this. So the only thing, I've proved it in such a way that it's irrefutable. So the only thing that the authorities can do is try to cheat. They can, you know, try to say, well, you know, so she's broken, you know, so she was faint, crowned on a fake stone, and so she'd broken her oath 1,000 times. So what? We don't care. And even though lawfully they couldn't do that, if they were to follow the points of law, as I've laid it all down in this filing that I filed with the court, there's no way they can argue with it, because it's absolutely correct lawfully. And but the other thing is they could handpick 12 members of a jury. They could dismiss, first of all, they could dismiss my challenge and say, well, we don't care, and try and do it without any audience, without anybody knowing, and then they would move on to put me on trial. Because if my challenge on the first day, on the 9th of May, if my challenge is successful, then the charge against me will drop, because as she's not the monarch, she can't take me to court, because on all of the documents that they file against me, it says the Queen versus me. And of course, if she's not the Queen, which she isn't, then she can't take me to court. And so if my challenge succeeds, as it lawfully and rightfully should do, then the charge against me will be null and void. But if they ride roughshod over me and refuse to accept my challenge, and say, well, we don't care about all these things, she's our queen and that's that, then my trial will start on the following day, on the 10th of May. And, of course, then the danger is that they would handpick a jury. These people are capable of anything. And if you watch the 7-7 Ripley fight, you'll see what kind of things they're capable of. There were 56 people murdered that day and about 800 injured and maimed. So they're capable of anything. And so it's possible that they could handpick 12 of their own people to sit on the jury and, you know, not listen to my defense and find me guilty. And it's a very serious charge. It doesn't sound very serious, but when you see that the penalty for it is a life sentence, you know, that they can give you a life sentence for it with a maximum of 20 years, then it's a very serious situation.
It's not only serious, I mean, it's not only ridiculous and absurd, but it's a quite a frightening case precedent to think that somebody who simply mails a DVD as a friend of the court in a proceeding can be extradited and treated to this type of treatment. I mean, anyone anywhere in the world should be concerned about this case and what's happening here and the case precedent that the UK courts are trying to set.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's why I'm very grateful to you and the other people who've done radio interviews with me. I'm very grateful to all of you for getting the publicity out there, because the more publicity that we get and the more people that turn up to the court on the 9th of May, the less chance they will have of keeping all this quiet and doing, you know, cheating, basically. if the spotlight of the public is on them, they will find it much more difficult to cheat. So, you know, I'm hoping that lots and lots of people will turn up that day. But, it's a very frightening thing. I sent these, you know, I was striving to prevent a miscarriage of justice. I was wanting to prevent the government, these authorities that carry out these atrocities, these false flag events, trying to stop them from perverting the course of justice. And then they had the audacity to accuse me of doing that when I'd sent the DVDs as an amicus curiae brief, which is Latin, it means a friend of the court. I'd sent the films there to educate the court as a friend of the court. An amicus curiae brief is where someone who is not directly involved in a court case, in a trial, sends information to the court. And that's what I did. Very important information. And it's also a criminal offence, a very serious criminal offence, not to report treason to the judiciary. Well, I'd sent the film to the Chief Constable of Birmingham. I'd sent it to the Chief Constable of West Yorkshire. I'd sent it to the Chief of Police at the police station where these young men were from in Leeds. I'd sent them to TV stations. I'd sent them to hundreds of mosques. I'd sent them to everybody that I could think of. And there'd been no real response, no investigation, no nothing had happened. So the fact that these three men, young men, were on trial for connected with the 7th of July 2005 bombings was the perfect place to send the film, because there's a charge, it's of misprision of treason. And that is that if you have evidence of treason having been committed, and you don't supply that evidence to the judiciary, then they can charge you with misprision of treason, which carries a life sentence. So I did everything that somebody should do, you know, that a law-abiding and righteous person should do. I did everything within my power to get this crime investigated. But of course, the people who carry it out don't want to investigate themselves, for obvious reasons.
That's exactly the point. And I think my listeners will not be surprised to hear about this entire story and to find that the so-called justice system is not about dispensing justice, but in to protect those who are guilty of the crimes that others are being charged of. It's again, quite an absurd situation. But I know there are a lot of people around the world, and many people, I'm sure, in the UK who are listening to this, who will want to follow this case and to support you in whatever way they can. How can they find out more information about this? And if they are actually in the UK, how can they go to actually support you during this case?
The case is... It starts, it's scheduled to start, if they don't pull any strokes and at the last minute change dates and whatever. It is scheduled to start on May the 9th at Southwark Crown Court in London. I'll spell that for you because it's spelled differently to the way Londoners pronounce it. It's S-O-U-T-H, as in South, all one word, S-O-U-T-H-W-A-R-K. Which, you know, I suppose you would pronounce Southwark, most people would, but the Londoners pronounce it Southwark. So it's Southwark Crown Court in London on the 9th of May. And the more people that turn up that day, if we can absolutely fill the court and maybe even ring the court with a ring of people, just to let them know that they're not going to get away with trying to hide this, that would be most helpful to me.
Absolutely. And how about for people who aren't in the UK and can't physically attend?
I'm not sure really what they could do.
Is there any way for people to stay up to date with what's happening? Are you updating your website, or is there any other organizations that are keeping up to date with this?
I used the name in making the film. I used the name Muad'Dib, and that's just so that people know it's nothing sinister. It's an Arab, it's Arabic, and it means teacher of righteousness or the educator. And of course, that's what I'm striving to do, is to teach them righteousness and educate the people as to what really went off. So I used that name in the film. And there is a website run by people calling themselves Friends of Muad'Dib. And I can give you the link for that. It's http://mtrial.org. I'll give it to you again. http://mtrial.org.
mtrial.org?
That's correct, yes, okay. And that's a site run by people calling themselves Friends of Muad'Dib, and they have listed everything that's happened to me, including the other interviews that I've done, and they will put this interview up there once you have done it and give me the link for it, to let people know if they want to study and see exactly what's happened and how absurd it is and how evil it is. They can see all of the I've had to go through and everything that they've done to me and how absurd all of this is at that website.
Absolutely.
But what they can also do is go to their local media and tell them and get the knowledge out, because most of your listeners, I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think that most of them are aware of the New World Order and the situation with the population reduction plans that they've got and all of that. Am I correct in that assumption?
If they've been listening to me for any amount of time, I would say you're correct, yes.
Right, okay. Well, they may not be aware of the fact that Elizabeth is actually the head of the New World Order. You may have heard of, maybe some of your listeners have, or maybe not, there's a book written by Dr. John Coleman, and it's called The Conspirators' Hierarchy, and the subtitle is The Committee of 300. And he's an ex-MI6 Secret Services operative, the British Secret Services. And he was on assignment, I think, in Angola many years ago, and he got access to documents that I don't think he was supposed to see, and definitely the public is not supposed to see. And he found out about this plan for the New World Order, and in it, it's a very interesting book, it's a very detailed book, and in it he says that she, Elizabeth, is the head of this conspiracy, this New World Order conspiracy, okay? So if you think of the New World Order conspiracy as being like a snake, because it's full of poison, venom, and it wants to kill people, the only way that you can kill a snake is to cut its head off. And she's the head of the New World Order. And what I'm doing is I'm striving in court on the 9th of May to cut the head off the New World Order. If I am successful, and this is how important this is to everybody that's listening, and to everybody in the world, is that if I can take her down on the 9th of May, the New World Order is finished. We can start to dismantle it.
That's right, and I'm sure the authorities are listening to this, so just in case there are any misconceptions, you are speaking figuratively, and you're talking about getting her dethroned because she was not properly coronated.
Exactly, okay. Yes.
Yes. Yes, well, I agree.
I want her arrested. I put that in my filing with the court as well, because she's a criminal. She's committed fraud. She's committed treason, as I've proved also in my filings. So she is a criminal. She needs to be arrested, and that's what I've asked for. So that's what I mean by cutting the head off. I mean to have her arrested, removed from the throne, and then the New World Order dismantled. So that's how important it is to everybody that's listening in, and to everybody that they know, because this plan for depopulation, we're talking about getting rid of 6,000 million of us. So it's that important. Have you done any research on the George Guidestones?
I've certainly heard of them. I've read the what's written on them, and yeah.
Okay, so you'll know that it contains the New World Order's Ten Commandments, and not God's Ten Commandments, but these evil people's Ten Commandments. And the number one commandment on the Georgia Guidestones, and that's Georgia as in the state of Georgia in America, because that's where these Georgia Guidestones are, and they were put up during the presidency of Jimmy Carter, who was a peanut farmer from the state of Georgia. But their number one commandment on these stones is that they want to reduce the population of the world and maintain it below 500 million people. If we take, for argument's sake, for simplicity of numbers, if we say that there are 6.5 thousand million people on the planet right now, that means they have to kill off 6,000 million people. And they intend to do that through wars and through disease and through poisoning people, through vaccines, through GM crops, through fluoride in the water, through aspartame in the diet drinks, and now they're putting it in foods. Many, many different things that your listeners may have heard of from you, from your broadcast, but if not, they need to research these things for themselves to see that it's all real. And it sounds so fantastic that most people would not want to believe it, wouldn't want to hear it even. But I can assure them that if they do the research, and I spent many, many years doing this research, that it's all true and this is exactly what these people want to do. They consider themselves to be elite and they consider everybody else to be useless eaters that they can do without. And if they get rid of everybody, then they own the whole earth. At the moment, they own about 75% of it, but they want it all. And that means getting rid of the majority of mankind and just keeping a few million people to grow their food for them, make their clothes and be their slaves and look after them. And I know it sounds fantastic, but it's true.
It certainly is, and the depopulation agenda of the eugenics-obsessed elite and the inbred royalty is something that is very familiar to my listeners, no doubt. So, absolutely, it's something that I keep coming back to time and again, and people really do need to look into every single aspect of that agenda and to think of all the things that we don't know yet. I mean, things like aspartame and things like that we've now known about for decades, but there are things they're doing now that we no doubt have no idea about yet, so... We are under attack from every perspective and every day of our lives from so many different chemicals and all the things that they're doing to try to poison this world. So it is something that we need to inform ourselves about and really detach ourselves from their systems of control.
Can I just mention, talking about chemicals and things like that and the pharmaceutical companies, because they're using vaccines also to depopulate the planet. They're putting poisons in the vaccines. But I want to particularly concentrate and mention Gardasil, because they brought out this vaccine called Gardasil, and they are trying to vaccinate all the 11 and 12 year old little girls in the Western world. I don't know about in the third world, but definitely they're pushing it in the developed world in the West. To take this vaccination, and it's called the human papilloma virus that this Gardasil is supposedly designed to prevent. And the independent studies that have been made prove that it doesn't have any effect on that to start with. But what it's been doing, it's been making these young girls, a lot of them, it's been making them very, very seriously ill, killing quite a number of them as well. But I believe that the underlying agenda with that is that there is something in that Gardasil vaccine that will sterilize these young women, these young girls. Because they want to reduce the world's population. Bill Gates has openly said that publicly, that they're going to reduce the world's population through vaccines. And I believe there's something in the Gardasil that will sterilize these young girls. And if they can sterilize the 11 and 12-year-old young girls, they will never have children and they will be achieving their ends. But think what that will do to your children and to your families, that your daughters will never be able to be mothers.
Exactly right, and people really do need to look into Gardasil, and now they're even recommending it for young men as well, as ridiculous as that might seem, but it's true, they are now trying to inject it into young boys, so... It's something that we need to inform ourselves about and to not accept and to try to detach ourselves from that control. But I'm afraid we're coming to the end of our time for this particular interview. Any final thoughts that you'd like to leave the listeners with before we go today?
Yes, please remember what I've said, that Elizabeth is the head of this conspiracy. And taking her down on the 9th of May is the most important thing that everybody can help to do. It's the most important thing that needs doing on this planet to stop all of these plans.
All right. Well, John Anthony Hill, thank you very much for your time today, and best of luck in your upcoming trial. And I hope that we'll be able to stay in touch after you successfully dethrone the Queen of England.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much for your help and for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.